Culture Affidavit, episode 152, The Crisis Hangover. Hello and welcome to episode 152 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Paneris. So I think my fellow geeks would agree with me that when you are a comic book reader, you often find yourself falling down rabbit holes and taking on reading projects that encompass certain characters, runs, titles, or eras. These can be everything from reading an entire series to a certain run on a book, or a smattering of issues that covers a certain particular storyline. I've done my fair share of these over the years, and now that I have subscriptions to both DC Infinite and Marvel Unlimited, those types of projects are so much easier than they were back when I had to rely on tracking down individual back issues or trades, which much of the time meant that the reading project itself would be incomplete because there would always be at least one book that was either hard to find or just simply too expensive for me to want to spend the money on. In the last few years, for instance, I've read the entire Chris Claremont X-Men run. I'm currently working my way through the Legion of Superheroes starting in the 1970s and then going all the way up to Zero Hour. I will confess, though, that I'm still in the 70s with this. But I've been able to read entire crossover events that I had no intention of spending a lot of money buying when they came out, such as Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths. I would have never paid the amount of money that would have cost to collect wholly, but read the whole thing through DC Infinite, not too bad. I mean, the cost, not the story. And I've also been able to entertain really niche interests. What I mean by really niche interests is coming up with a very specific idea to explore when reading a set of titles or one title. It might be all of the appearances of a specific supporting or third tier character, or all of the mentions or appearances of a character after their big moment in the spotlight, or a very specific comic period of comic book history that isn't officially a period of comic book history, so it doesn't have a name, at least not until I give it one. That sounds pompous, because I'm sure that I'm not the only person to name or give a nickname to a very small period in comics, and I'm sure that I'm not the only person to give a name to the interregnum between the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths and the beginning of Man of Steel. In fact, I'm sure that someone much better at reviewing and podcasting about comics has a much better name for it than the Crisis Hangover, but that's what I always think of when I look at comic books published between December of 1985 and July of 1986. And for me, anyway, the phrase hangover is appropriate because I've always held to the theory that decades, at least in terms of their popular cultural style and identity, don't really coalesce until a few years in. So at the very beginning of a decade, you have a hangover period where the residue of what came before is slowly being washed away. Dave Holmes puts this more eloquently than I ever could in his piece, The Two Weirdest Years in Music. This appeared in the July 23rd, 2023 issue of Esquire. He says, "There is a moment in musical history at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s that is not quite the former and not yet the latter. A formless, colorless span of time whose music can't be lumped in with the peppy, peppy pop and rock of the Reagan era, nor the groundbreaking indie R&B and hip-hop of the Clinton years, and is thus in danger of being forgotten. It's not even a span of time as much as a sliver, a slice. Two or three strange years as one era evolved into another. This slice is fizzy and sweet and ultimately not satisfying. It is the diet slice." And if you're interested in reading the rest of the article, I will link it to it in the show notes. I love the way he describes those 2 years. He calls them the Diet Slice era. And I thought about this article as I was putting this episode together, because that 9 month period or so in DC Comics is kind of their Diet Slice period. The crisis was ostensibly over, but aspects of the pre-crisis DCU lingered while the post-crisis itself was getting started. It wouldn't be until the publication of Man of Steel number 1 where the post-crisis DCU was officially here. And we're all familiar with the terms crisis and pre-crisis and post-crisis. I'm going to further define things as well as talk about how I've decided to organize my episode. The universe created for the post-crisis officially begins on the first page of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 11. After the heroes and the Spectre fought the Anti-Monitor at the dawn of time, the multiverse shattered, and what was once many, as the narration boxes say, became one. The first hero we see dealing with the Aftershock, which is the title of the story, is the Superman of Earth 2. And as we go through the issue, we learn about the new version of Earth, and also that a number of heroes exclusive to Earth 2 never existed, or nobody knows who they are, so they are out of place. At the end of issue 11, the Earth is pulled into the antimatter universe. Issue 12 is the final battle with the Anti-Monitor. In fact, in the post-crisis DCU, the crisis did occur, and I venture to say that this single day, which is what I believe is the time frame of these two issues, is what people in that universe remember. After the battle is over, Harbinger, who had already begun to catalog the history of the universe, vows to keep that work going. And that work would become The History of the DC Universe, written by Marv Wolfman with art by George Perez and Carl Kiesel, which was published in 1986. And I talked about, last year at some point, where I talked about that and Marvel Saga and the history of the Marvel Universe. So you can go check that one out. These two Crisis issues were published in November and December of 1985. Man of Steel number 1 came out on July 10th, 1986, and that's what I'm going to use as the demarcation points for this crisis hangover. Your mileage may vary on whether or not I'm correct, and you can certainly email me if you want to, if you feel really strongly about it, but I think that with a few exceptions, this does work, especially since Man of Steel is such a banner event. In the crisis hangover, some of the books kept going for a little while, some went into their post-crisis continuity right away, and others had a foot in both the pre- and post-crisis universes for a while before they finally settled in. To prepare for this, I took a look at Mike's Amazing World and made a list of everything that DC published between those two dates. Then I broke them out into 5 categories. And before I get to those, by the way, I would like to make a quick note that Mike Voyles, who was the Mike of Mike's Amazing World, passed away a while back. So much of what I've written or blogged about would not have been possible without him. Plus, Mike was the webmaster for the first iteration of the 22 Freaks website and helped keep things running smoothly for years. So I'd like to thank him for everything. I'm going to dedicate this episode to him. So the first category I've set my books out as, it's called Keep On Going, self-explanatory. While these books might have had minor adjustments, the books went on without a huge shift in the status quo. Next up, The Refresh. These books underwent a soft reboot. Maybe there was a change in location or new team members, or a few changes were necessary, but for the most part, they were able to pick up where they left off and just keep going. Then there are The New Kids on the Block. Also self-explanatory, these are brand new titles with characters and concepts that were new to the DCU in some way or another. And my last two categories have to do with endings. First, there's the series finale. It involves books that were canceled and had no immediate reboot, although the characters themselves would go on. And with it is the end of an era. That, of course, is the true ending of a character, and even though the character would continue to be published, they would be made over, and there's a clear delineation between the pre-crisis and post-crisis versions. So, let's look at these comics. Well, right after this. Stick around.
In all his decades of publishing history, one event has affected Superman more than any other. Worlds lived, worlds died, and that was only the beginning. Superman was never the same. Presenting Superman in Crisis. Available weekly from January 3rd, 2022 at johnreadscomics.com.
Before I get to the different categories of comics and what happened in their corresponding titles, I want to let you know that what didn't fit into any category and isn't getting covered. Between November 1985 and July of 1986, DC published just over 50 individual titles. Some were on the stands when Crisis ended, others came out after the series ended in January, but before the end of 1986. I will be sticking to what would have fallen within the mainstream continuity of the DCU. Nowadays, that would mean pretty much all of DC's monthly solicits. But back in 1986, there were a number of books DC published that weren't part of the main line. Now, this is pre-Vertigo, so the idea of creating a separate imprint for the titles that weren't superhero books hadn't come about yet. But DC does have a pretty rich history of publishing outside the superhero genre. If you want to hear me talk about that, check out my miniseries from 2015 and 2016, called 80 Years of DC Comics. So the books that I won't be covering or have not lumped into on this show are Shadow of the Batman, Roots of the Swamp Thing, Tales of the Teen Titans, and Tales of the Legion of Superheroes, all of which were reprint books in Baxter format of classic stories. DC Challenge, which was a superhero book but deliberately written to be outside of continuity, I may cover this one day, though, because it's such a fun little series. Superpowers, which had another series around this time and sort of ties into Jack Kirby's New Gods, but isn't part of the main DCU. Atari Force, which was coming to its end around the end of Crisis. Elvira's House of Mystery. Angel Love. Lords of the Ultra Realm, which is a licensed character tie-in with TSR. DC has this line of original science fiction graphic novels that starts around this time or had been running for a little bit, and those aren't going to be covered either. Dark Knight. Dark Knight was influential on the post-crisis Batman, but when Frank Miller wrote and drew it, it was not supposed to be within the continuity of Batman, or at least that's my understanding, so I'm not going to lump that into the post-crisis, pre-crisis, post-crisis era. Watchmen, likely. But Watchmen, Watchmen looms large in terms of its influence, but it is its own thing. And it was always its own thing when it was published back in 1986. V, Star Trek, The Shadow, Electric Warrior, which I'm pretty sure is also not part of the mainstream DCU, and I don't think Amazing Man is either. So those are the titles I am not covering or talking about. And with those out of the way, I will get to the books that I am. Some of them I'm just going to mention briefly. A few others I'll just give a little more attention. There's quite a few. So my first category is Keep On Going. These books pretty much stayed the way they were. Or if they changed anything, it was more because of what was going on in the titles themselves and not a result of the crisis. My quick takes. Who's who? Well, the entries do start to reflect the post-crisis DCU, and that means we don't get a proper Earth 1 Superman or Wonder Woman entry. The book isn't that affected by anything. If you want to know what Who's Who was like back then, there is the Who's Who podcast over on the Fire and Water Network with Shag and Rob, and it is outstanding. They've done all of the Who's Who books, the definitive directive, the updates, and the loose leaf, and it's just amazing. So check that out. Warlord. I've only read a smattering of Warlord comics, but from what I can tell, is that Travis Morgan makes an appearance or maybe one or two panels in Crisis on Infinite Earths. As far as his title was concerned, though, things just chugged along. Darren and Ruth Sutherland of the Rad Adventures Network have a podcast called Warlord Worlds. I recommend you check that out if you want to learn about more about Travis Morgan. And they also cover other things by Mike Grell and also Ron Randall. So check them out over on the Rad Adventures Network. The Fury of Firestorm, the Nuclear Man, is next. And Shag, who runs the Firestorm, you know, the Firestorm blog, he is the fire in the fire and water. He's been covering Firestorm for years. Shag can correct me here, but I'm pretty sure that not very much changed in this book as a result of Crisis, aside from Firehawk getting a new costume. In fact, the book more or less keeps its status quo until we hit Legends. That's around the beginning of the John Ostrander run, and that takes Firestorm in a completely new direction through the mid to late 80s and into the very early 90s. I think the book gets canceled around 1990 or 91. Hex. This Mad Max-esque take on Jonah Hex started around the time of the Crisis and is mentioned at both the end of issue number 12 and the history of the DC Universe. Hex gets canceled with issue number 18. It comes out once a month, and issue 18 comes out a month after our stopping point. It makes Hex one of the shorter ongoings of this era, and I think it's the only one that started during the Crisis and ended right at the beginning of the post-Crisis era, or at least how I'm defining all of this. I've got about half the run. From what I've read, I've enjoyed it. I'm definitely looking forward to trying to find the remaining issues. Blue Devil, like Hex, this book is canceled in 1986, but the final issue comes out the same month that Man of Steel number 5 and number 6 do, so I'm putting it here because there's almost a solid year's worth of stories after Crisis, and from what I could tell, the book just keeps going and there's no real effect from the event. Shag has been talking about Blue Devil lately over on Once Upon a Geek. I am really sorry to everybody that I'm plugging Shag's podcast so much. I really am. Anyway, but you should definitely check that out. Next up is Hawkman, which is kind of muddy. I know there's the Shadow War of Hawkman, and there's an ongoing that starts right before Superman number 423 comes out. So technically, that is a post-Crisis version of the Kadar Hall Hawkman, except that a few years later, we get Hawk Worlds. Luke Jack and Eddie can probably clear all of this up as to, like, what is the post-Crisis, pre-Crisis Hawkman, Thanagarian Hawkman. Because honestly, trying to fit Hawkman into the Crisis on Infinite Earths and post-Crisis continuity is about as headache-inducing as trying to do so with Donna Troy. Next up is the Vigilante. This is one of those that has a caveat, because when we start the set of issues of Vigilante that correspond with this era, Adrian Chase is not in the titular role. It's somebody else who is more violent and mentally unhinged. He winds up being killed by Peacemaker in issue number 36, and that draws Adrian Chase back into the costume. So it's more like one of those season finales that resets the status quo. Vigilante, by the way, will end with Adrian Chase's suicide in issue number 50, amidst Paul Kupperberg setting up the Checkmate book, which used some of Vigilante's supporting characters and started up just as Vigilante was ending. Those last few issues, by the way, of Vigilante are something. They're not the greatest. I really appreciate what he did with the character, Kupperberg did with the character as to finish things out. And I could see Checkmate getting set up, and it seemed like they were going to invite Vigilante or Adrian Chase to become part of Checkmate. And I've read some of Checkmate, and I've enjoyed that. But it is a nice little slice of DC from a particular point of view that is very street level and brutal sometimes, and really, really worth checking out if you can hunt down those issues. I think some of them are on DC Infinite. All right, back into our list here. I've got Infinity Incorporated, and it's actually more involved than I'm giving it right now, but I want to save Infinity Inc. for when I look at the All-Star Squadron, because the Infinitors are tied to the JSA, and the JSA truly has the end of an era. But Infinity Inc. pretty much continues kind of as it is, so just put a pin in that for now. All right, and then a little bit more of my quick takes, then I'm going to get into my longer ones, and next up is Swamp Thing. This is one I probably don't need to get into too much because Alan Moore's Swamp Thing run is so iconic that if you haven't read it, you've at least heard of it. Anyway, Swamp Thing intersects with Crisis issues 44 and 46. Issue 44 has actually more to do with John Constantine and Steve Dayton than it does Swamp Thing. Issue 46 is a full-blown Crisis crossover, and you can kind of tell that Moore was doing an "Okay, Mom" version of a crossover where he had Constantine and Swamp Thing sent aboard the Monitor satellite for the Everyone in the Room sequence in Crisis number 5. Now, once they're back down to Earth, Constantine's all, "Yeah, the Crisis is bad, but there's something else coming, and that's much worse." And that's what they'll encounter. Moore eventually names it the Great Darkness. It leads up to a pretty epic finale with a number of magic-oriented characters taking on this evil. And, well, I don't want to get too much into it because this story is outstanding and Swamp Thing number 50 is phenomenal. But Alan Moore managed to keep on going with his book and take it in whatever direction he wanted. In the long run, that's really good because it's the genesis of the Vertigo line that would start in the early 1990s. So in this category, we have three things left: the Legion, the Justice League, and the Titans. I'll start with the Titans since they have a connection to that Swamp Thing storyline with the character Steve Dayton, who, because of the events of both Crisis and Swamp Thing, along with his own alcoholism, has descended into madness and taken a heel turn as Mento. Changeling and Cyborg's efforts to find him, stop him, and free him from that madness is one of three storylines that begins during the two Crisis crossover issues and continues for about a year and a half. The other two storylines deal with Starfire and Raven. Starfire's storyline was seeded in issue number 1 of the Baxter series. It coincided with the events of the Omega Men, and it began in earnest in issue 14. It's the second of the two Crisis crossover issues. So basically what happened is that Temeran is free from this control of the Citadel, and now she's being called home because she has to marry Prince Karras in this, you know, kind of transactional royal wedding to unite the two kind of houses of Temeran. And Starfire and Karras are both actually in relationships that they're trying to keep. Nightwing and Jericho go with her, and it doesn't end very well for Dick. He comes back to Earth and gets ensnared in the third plot, which is the resurrection of Raven and the return of Brother Blood. The Brother Blood storylines ends in issue 31, and that's the closest thing you have to the end of the pre-Crisis New Teen Titans, because this storyline does have a guest appearance by Jason Todd, and the way Marv Wolfman writes him, he's clearly the pre-Crisis Jason Todd, and the post-Crisis Robin actually doesn't make his debut until the following month. So, and Mike's Amazing World actually ends the pre-Crisis Titans with that issue, so that's what I'm going with. Of course, I'm stretching it. Because I'm kind of the exception to the rule here. Titans 31 comes out after Man of Steel, a few months into the Burn Superman run, actually. But, you know, it's my show. I can't say I actually recommend this stretch of Titans books, if I'm being honest. There is some really good stuff in here. It also becomes very soap opera-like. It drags, and after this, the book meanders terribly for the better part of 2 or 3 more years. There are worse stretches of the New Teen Titans / New Titans, mostly in the 90s. So I guess that's why I give this a little bit more of a pass. But if you want to read them, they're all in DC Infinite, and they are all in trade and hardcover. So you can track them down pretty easily. But yeah, like I said, it's a storyline that there are storylines that went on for like a year and a half or so that could have probably been a couple issues shorter. Now, as for the Justice League, they do keep on going. Crisis on Infinite Earths happened smack in the middle of the Detroit era, which seems to have gotten a bit more love in recent years than I remember back when I was reading comics in the 90s and 2000s. I'd always thought of this stretch of the Justice League comics as the Coy and Vance years, but in reading the books from the Crisis crossover with the JSA all the way to the end, I found it's really solid. The League doesn't change much as a result of the events of the Crisis. They move headquarters, that's about it. They move headquarters, and that's about it. It's the next crossover, Legends, that completely upends the concept of the Justice League. But I highly recommend the stretch of issues between Crisis and Legends, especially the storyline where Despero returns and takes on the League, who's now being led by Batman, who's more or less a dick to everyone around him, as Batman tends to be. Anyway, the Detroit stuff has been collected. It is available digitally. I think it's underrated. It's definitely worth checking out, especially this back half of its run. And finally, in our keep on going category, there is the Legion of Superheroes. Now, there were serious changes to the backstory of the Legion because Crisis eliminated both Superboy and Supergirl. But that doesn't get fully addressed until roughly a year into the post-Crisis era, when Superman and Action Comics cross over with the Legion, and we have the whole pocket universe concept. And quite a bit would come from this with repercussions into the 1990s. But between issues 19 and 28 of the Legion Baxter series, there's just the continuing adventures of the Legion, much of which involves the true identity of Censor Girl, appearances by various villains, a battle against the Fatal Five, and a Legionnaires 3 miniseries that will lead into Legends, and the Cosmic Boy miniseries that's part of that Legends event. I mentioned how the Titans was very soap operatic during this time. So was the Legion. It can be a little hard to keep track of things, especially since we're seeing the departure of old members and the coming of new members of the team throughout the set of issues. It is a little bit X-Men in that regard, but it's still really worth reading, especially because Greg LaRocque's art is great and he handles the large cast that Paul Levitz created very, very well. So now we move on to category number 2, and that is the refresh. These books got the same treatment that a long-running television show might get when it needs a change. Maybe the ratings were down or the budget's been cut. So it's the same show, but there's a new direction and new casting. The difference is noticeable. It's kind of a soft reboot as well. We see this in, I think, Aquaman. This is the miniseries that introduced the blue suit, and if I remember correctly, made some post-Crisis tweaks to his origin, but things pretty much stayed the same, or at least as far as I can tell. Rob Kelly runs the Aquaman Shrine. He's the expert on Aquaman. Go check out his stuff and his both the Aquaman Shrine and the Fire and Water show, and also check out all of Rob's other podcasts because they're all amazing. Anyway, Aquaman's post-Crisis history is kind of spotty anyway. He won't have an ongoing until the early 90s, and that barely lasts a year. It's not until the mid-90s where things gel a little more. But before that, there's a couple of miniseries and specials in the 80s, including the Atlantis Chronicles. I've read a couple of issues out of that and enjoyed, and I intend to read the rest of it when I get the chance. Next up on the refresh list is Batman and the Outsiders. This book had started after Batman famously quit the Justice League and then recruited his group of young and inexperienced heroes. I've only read a few things here and there, most notably the issue that crosses over with the new Teen Titans. And the way they get a decent spotlight in Crisis makes me think that they were popular or kind of a big deal at the time. At any rate, Batman ditches the team, and the team moves to LA, where they are one of the last DC titles to get what was called the hardcover, softcover treatment. Because the Batman and the Outsiders becomes Adventures of the Outsiders, and the Outsiders themselves get a Baxter series, so eventually Adventures becomes the reprint book. This isn't as successful as either the Titans and the Legion's forays into this Baxter world, as the Outsiders would end with issue number 28 in the middle of Millennium. Speaking of Millennium, the last book I have in this category is Green Lantern. So Green Lantern actually has one of the better Crisis crossover arcs. It takes place over the course of 4 issues. There's this saga that takes place beside the crisis. John Stewart is recruited by the Monitor. The Guardians of the Universe fight amongst themselves. One of them gives a ring to Guy Gardner. There's the death of Tomar Ree, and at the end, Hal Jordan gets his ring back. He had quit in issue 181. Issues 199 and 200 are the end of the series, though, sort of. They deal with the fallout of the crisis, and then the Guardians and Zamorans take off to make sweet, sweet space love, leaving the Green Lantern Corps on their own. The result? A title change and a setting change. The book becomes The Green Lantern Corps, features stories with various team members. It lasts 2 years, ending with issue number 224. That's the one where the power battery on Oa is destroyed, and everyone except a few lanterns loses their powers. I've read a few issues and the series is hit or miss. There are some great characters like Kilowog and Chip, but then there's also some real clunkers. The Corps is the centerpiece of Millennium, after which the book is canceled. The late 1980s pre-Emerald Dawn Green Lantern stuff would be an interesting idea for a podcast episode or two, to be completely honest. So not, seriously, I'm falling down rabbit holes as I record this. Anyway, like I said, these three books pretty much keep on going, but had enough adjustments to warrant a different look. It's a small group, and our next is a small group, and that's the New Kids on the Block. These are only three books, because there are only three books that start out as true post-crisis books as opposed to, like, new series with existing characters. Okay, one of these was technically an existing character, but he'd been published by another company prior to his first DC series. I'm surprised that DC didn't try to debut more characters after Crisis, especially since they seemed to have the right stuff in the late 80s. Maybe they were just taking it step by step? DC's been known to play games from time to time, so maybe they were worried that we wouldn't be loving these books forever. And that's certainly the case with both Blue Beetle and Booster Gold. They lasted 2 years. Characters then got bigger spotlight in Justice League America and gained even more popularity over there, the Bwahaha years. I did a podcast on that too, okay? Now, I don't think I've read more than one issue of Booster Gold. Sorry. I probably will go do that at some point, because I like Dan Jurgens. I like Booster Gold. Blue Beetle, though, the Blue Beetle is a really good book. I've read a few issues that had crossovers with events like Legends of Millennium and story arcs that guest starred the new Teen Titans. All of them were really solid. It was a really, really good read, so I'd recommend tracking those down if you have the chance. The third one of these series, though, is, and the one that lasted the longest, is Secret Origins. That went all the way to 1989 or so, 1990, with issue number 50. This book debuted the month after Crisis ended, and it more or less spins out of some of the origin stories that Roy Thomas had set up in the last few issues of All-Star Squadron. For a while, the book features the origin of a Golden Age character coupled with a more modern character, and then the issues become thematic after a change in editorship from Roy Thomas to Mark Waid. It's an outstanding series. The first issue focuses on the Golden Age Superman with art by Wayne Boring and Jerry Ordway. Thomas would later write a Golden Age Batman story that was drawn by Marshall Rogers. That's also wonderful. I love Secret Origins. It was a great companion to Who's Who. It gave us all a great look at the post-crisis DCU while also updating a number of classic stories for that era. I recommend checking out all three of these titles. If you're really interested in Secret Origins, Ryan Daly did a Secret Origins podcast, and I believe that's still up over on the Fire and Water Network. And Secret Origins is such a great one. I recently completed my run of the book, and just about every issue is worth the search. But for every new kid on the block, there's one who leaves. And DC had a number of series finales in the Crisis hangover. Clearly, sales were flagging. Something else brought about their end. So everything wrapped up before we got to Legends. In some cases, there were post-crisis revamps and reboots, but those would come later than where I'm talking about. There's only three here because the others that were canceled or had series finales are going to fit into my end of an era category. It'll be a little more in depth. First up, the Omega Men. this was limping along during the crisis. It crossed over with the new Teen Titans, and it finishes up with issue number 38. The team did have a revival a few years ago, but after this book went, they weren't very important to the overall DCU, making appearances here and there in some outer space stories. I think a bunch of them are in the first issue of Invasion. It's a shame, too, because what I've read was pretty solid. You know, Mega Men is one of the first, if not the first, of DC Vector format books. So maybe it was just the sales there weren't warranting anything. But yeah, the outer space adventure stuff just, it was, you know, you don't get a lot of outer space sci-fi books in the post-crisis DCU when you really think about it. Most of it is, aside from Green Lantern, is very, very earthbound. So maybe that's just what they thought people were going to want. Another book that gets its series finale around this time is Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld. It kind of falls into refresh category a little bit because with issue 13, that was the Crisis crossover issue. Amethyst is blinded by shadow demons, and then she's taken away by Dr. Fate, and it's revealed that she is a Lord of Order and doesn't even know it. But the book only goes to issue 16, and it ends with a special. That makes me think that the writers might have planned on everything to continue, but they were faced with cancellation and had to wrap things up. Amethyst as a series is interesting, especially in that last 6 months to a year of stories. There's this whole subplot involving this kid who kind of seduces Amethyst's best civilian friend, and the girl basically kills her father and then is carted away to a mental hospital. Then Amethyst herself goes to fight this character called Child, who is a Lord of Chaos, and they merge with Gemworld in order to save it. It's eventually followed up with this miniseries by Keith Giffen, Mindy Newell, and Esteban Moroto that I've read three issues of. I'm tracking down the fourth. It kind of continues the story, or at least is a sequel to it, and it ties the book in with the Legion of Superheroes, although apparently Amethyst's appearance in Infinite Crisis retcons that miniseries. I don't know. But I will say that the ending of the series is satisfying, if a bit rushed. I like the way that DC allowed the series that were being canceled to finish up their storylines, either within the book or by putting out like an oversized special or annual. I don't know the details of what went on behind the scenes to finish the series so soon after it changed directions, but I get the feeling that issues 17 and 18 were more or less finished. DC decided to shove those into the special with the epilogue, which has art by Esteban Moroto. Perhaps it was just written for that special. The epilogue calls upon a trope we've seen in a number of places. It takes place around a campfire, and these people are telling stories about Amethyst, more or less debating which one is the best version. A cloaked figure is among them listening, and in the very end, they ask which of them they think is true. She turns, and we see that it's a blonde girl. It's clearly Amethyst herself, and she says, "Does it really matter, my friend? Truth is at best a fragile, fleeting thing, but legends live forever." It's a nice button on the whole story, and I like Moroto's artwork, so I'm looking forward to reading the miniseries when I finally finish it. Speaking of gorgeous artwork and the ending of a story, the last title in this category is the four-issue Dead Man miniseries. It's published in 1986. It was written by Andrew Helfer and drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. This series wraps up the Dead Man story and as it had been told across various titles since the character debuted in the late Silver Age, and also kind of serves as the end of this particular iteration of the character. So it straddles the line of the series finale category and the end of an era category. The 1986 miniseries picks up where stories retold in a Baxter Paper reprint series had left off, and it features the battle for and destruction of Nanda Parbat, which is where Deadman had settled at the end of the prior set of stories. The result is that Boston Brand is basically let back into the world to continue his work, and he does wind up being embroiled in the Swamp Thing series and has a storyline in Action Comics Weekly. I don't know how high up in the pantheon Deadman is to really say that this is an end of an era. but the character fundamentally changed as we got further into the post-crisis era, or at least seemed to be different than what we would see in the pre-crisis era. This story, the Helfer and JLGL story, felt really Bronze Age to me, and it feels like we are finishing up with the character in the Bronze Age. So that's why I'm putting it here, kind of straddling this line. That miniseries, by the way, is worth tracking down. I was a little confused at first because I'd read it before I read the reprints of the older stuff, but Helfer does a good job of catching the audience up, and Garcia Lopez's art just plain gorgeous. I mean, this is JLGL at the top of his game. That alone is enough for me to recommend it. So let's get to that other category, that end of an era category. This is a self-explanatory thing, but they are books or characters whose books ended and what became after was fundamentally different. In some cases, the post-crisis version of the character is significantly different than their pre-crisis version. In other cases, the differences were significant enough to make the pre- and post-crisis eras distinct. In one case, it was the swan song of an era of DC itself. I'll start with that last item, because I'm talking about both Sergeant Rock and G.I. Combat. Now, these books ended way after Man of Steel number one came out. G.I. Combat's last issue was published in December of 1986, and Sergeant Rock lasted until March of 88. What I've read of DC's latter-day war books was some good stuff, but they were some of the last vestiges of the old DC, as the company pivoted towards science fiction and horror in its non-superhero genre stuff, and war comics, along with Western and romance, would never gain permanent footing again. It's still cool to see Rock and Easy Company show up and be handled by different creative teams, but this is the end of the long-running Robert Kaniger and Joe Kubert era, which defined the character and ostensibly DC's war comics. So it does not truly fit into the Crisis Hangover chronology. It needed its moment here. Another era that ended, which I'll only give a brief mention of, is that of Wonder Woman. The reason I am only giving it a little bit of a mention, because I actually already covered this. I covered the end of the pre-crisis Wonder Woman in episode 71, and that came out in 2017. In that show, I covered two series called The Legend of Wonder Woman, the first of which is written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Trina Robbins. It was a Golden Age-style flashback type of story, but the death of Diana at the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 12 was acknowledged, and Wonder Woman herself was essentially wiped away for the sake of rebirth at the hand of George Perez the following year. If you want the end of the Wonder Woman pre-Crisis era, I would recommend this. But I also recommend the three Crisis crossovers that ended the original series, the last few issues of Crisis itself, and that Legend of Wonder Woman book, because the Perez stuff is completely different. Really good, so check out the Paris stuff as well. Next up, Batman. Batman's pre-crisis era ends with a two-parter. The first part is Detective Comics number 366, and the conclusion comes in Batman number 400. In these issues, someone sends some threatening letters to Batman, telling him to know his foes before breaking all of his enemies out of Arkham Asylum. Batman 400 features the dynamic duo trying to capture as many of those people as possible while also figuring out who is behind it and confronting that villain. If that sounds familiar, like maybe like Nightfall, it kind of is. And partially because Doug Mensch, who wrote a lot of Nightfall, wrote Batman number 400. But unlike Nightfall, which saw Batman broken by the Big Bad and was the first in a very long saga, Batman 400 features the Dark Knight defeating his ultimate adversary, who is Ra's al Ghul. Now, if there is a better confrontation to conclude Batman's Bronze Age, I don't know what is. Ra's al Ghul is the quintessential Bronze Age Batman villain. Batman 400 also sends him off in a great way. It's an issue full of various artists telling Mensch's story, a celebration of 400 issues, much in the same vein of like Superman's 400th issue, although that was a much different type of story. So I own a copy of Batman 400. I've always enjoyed it. It's interesting that whereas the end of Wonder Woman has her fading away and Superman's end is, well, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, this just has Batman winning and then recommitting himself to his war on crime. The character goes on. And I think that is quite possibly the best, quote, ending, because Batman has so many different iterations over the years and is still Batman, right? Batman 401 does kick off the post-crisis era, though, with a cover featuring Magpie, who was introduced in the Man of Steel miniseries. Then there's a two-issue storyline where he faces off like with a Batman imposter. And then year one begins in issue number 404. When you read that, you don't see a fundamental difference in the backstory of Batman that Frank Miller tells as opposed to what Bill Finger and Bob Kane told nearly 50 years earlier. It is updated. It has a different tone. There's some extra characters, but it is fundamentally the same. And why? You don't need to do too much to Batman. And by the time 1986 rolled around, he'd already had something like four or five different versions. You know, you had the original Finger Kane stories, the Golden Age with Robin, the 50s stories that kind of went science fiction and was kind of goofy at times too. The Silver Age New Look Batman, the Bronze Age Dark Knight that began with Neil O'Neill and Adams. But I'd say that issue 400 truly ends an era for the character, because if you start with Batman 401 and move forward, you truly don't need to read anything prior to that to get a full understanding of the Dark Knight's story and continuity. Plus, the post-crisis era makes huge changes to Batman's world and supporting cast, especially Robin and Commissioner Gordon. I am hot and cold on the post-crisis Jason Todd. I love the post-crisis Jim Gordon, though. So like I said, it's enough of a change to warrant the end of an era. And look, we can have as long of a discussion as we want about where the post-crisis Batman fully coalesces, because it really isn't like with Batman 401, or even with Year One. That's another podcast for another day. I'll just end with saying that Batman 400 is an amazing story. It is definitely worth tracking down. Now, things are getting a little more complicated here because I have to talk about what happened to Earth 2. When Crisis started, the heroes of Earth 2 were starring in two monthly titles. You had All-Star Squadron, and that specifically chronicled the adventures of the JSA during World War II. And you had Infinity Incorporated, which took place in the modern day and starred their children and other members of that team's next generation. After the climactic battle between the Spectre and the Anti-Monitor in Crisis number 10, we find out that all of the remaining Earths in the multiverse were recreated as one single Earth, and that the Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman of Earth 2 never existed, nor did a few other heroes, such as Robin and the Huntress. The problem? Well, because they were part of that battle at the dawn of time, they were still there, and they remembered the multiverse, but nobody else did. By the end of Crisis, the redundant Earth 2 characters are either killed off or sent to seemingly happy endings, and the remaining heroes continue on their adventures as if they were always on that single Earth. This put Roy Thomas, who was writing both the All-Star Squadron and Infinity Inc., alongside his wife Dan, in a bind. Superman, Batman, and Robin, and Wonder Woman were prominent members of the All-Star Squadron. Huntress was a Latter-day Justice Society hero, as was Power Girl. But Power Girl and Fury, and she's the daughter of the Golden Age Wonder Woman, for some reason still existed on the New Earth. And he had to reconcile all of these things. So this leads to a few months of stories that help retcon or explain away the changes, although the All-Star Squadron does get canceled and Infinity Inc. will keep going. Thomas will introduce the young All-Stars in, I think, like 1987 or so. I know that ran for a couple of years as well, and it was supposed to kind of plug the hole that All-Star Squadron had left. I've heard mixed things about Young All-Stars. I've always been kind of curious about it. I may check it out because it's on DC Infinite, but I can't tell you whether or not it's good. Now, in All-Star Squadron, there's a three-part storyline where a robot named Mechanique, who had appeared in the JSA team-up during Crisis, arrives in New York after the Crisis is seemingly over. She is damaged and she seeks out other robotic forms, starting with the squadron's robot butler. This alerts the team and its robot man, who has this whole, "You think I'm a robot, but I'm actually human," chip on his shoulder, who protects her and repairs her. Eventually, she reveals to Robot Man that she's from the 23rd century and is actually the robot that is created in Fritz Lang's movie Metropolis, sent back in time to prevent the rebellion against the oppressive government of the future from happening. As part of her mission, she has been holding back the effects of the crisis on Infinite Earths until it is complete. Once it is, she lets it happen, and we see that change in the All-Star Squadron's team photo, which goes from having Superman, Batman, Robin, and Wonder Woman to front and center, to Uncle Sam and the members of the Freedom Fighters front and center. Mechanique also appears again in annuals for Young All-Stars and Infinity Inc., in a storyline that also stars Per Degaton. I have not read that, but I might check it out. As for the All-Star Squadron book, well, the issue where Mechanique changes the timeline is essentially their last adventure, as the remaining 7 issues of the series are the origin stories of several different members, akin to what Roy Thomas was doing over in Secret Origins. The Justice Society would appear again in the extra-length special The Last Days of the Justice Society of America. In that special, they learn that in order to stop Hitler from using the Spear of Destiny to bring Ragnarok upon the world and ultimately destroy it, they have to fight the battle in an infinite loop. The result is that all of them except the Spectre, Dr. Fate, and Power Girl are stuck in a limbo fighting the battle as avatars for the Norse gods for eternity. They would eventually get rescued in Armageddon Inferno, which is a forgettable series, except for the fact that it leads into the much too short Justice Society of America book by Lynch, Straczynski, and Mike Parabek. Way too short of a series. Now, the epilogue to The Last Days of the Justice Society of America is in Infinity Incorporated number 30. This is where the Infinitors attend the funerals of Robin and the Huntress alongside the JSA, during which the JSA is plucked from existence. The 3 survivors return. They all have to deal with the fallout. Power Girl eventually gets a new origin through Secret Origins and her own miniseries, which ties her to Arion of Atlantis instead of the Earth 2 Superman. Geoff Johns famously retcons all of this in Infinite Crisis, by the way. Fury is a little more complicated. She watches her mother and father ascend to Mount Olympus. She's devastated. So what does Brainwave do? He mind wipes her to make her feel better without her knowing. Yeah. Fury, by the way, ends up having a really interesting history after Crisis. There's her relationship with Hector Hall, the Silver Scarab, who gets killed and then resurrected to be the next Sandman by the end of the Infinity Inc. series. Now, she was already pregnant with his kid when he died, so when he comes back, they marry. Then Neil Gaiman picks her up and has Morpheus kill Hector, or more appropriately, return him to the land of the dead. And Fury's son, Daniel, becomes the next Sandman, the one that kind of takes Morpheus's place after Morpheus dies at the end of the Sandman series. But Fury is the one who helps instigate the events that eventually bring about Morpheus's downfall. Seeing how Gaiman picked up what Roy Thomas had left after Infinity Incorporated's end is a really fascinating rabbit hole to go down. Because you only have to read like the smattering of some early Sandman issues and then like the Kindly One storyline, which is like a climactic storyline, as well as like a few of the later issues of Infinity Incorporated, just to kind of get that thread. And I found it to be really, really fascinating. It was good stuff. And I will say I appreciated how Thomas did his best to have the Earth 2 heroes get some sort of send-off, especially considering he was probably the writer and editor most affected by the events of the Crisis. I mean, whether or not this was all good, yes or no. I like Roy Thomas. There are times, though, where his writing is really dense to the point where it can be tough to get through a storyline. I'm not trying to be mean or overly critical here. He did such cool things with all these characters. All-Star Squadron, the last day of the special, they're all highlights here because Infinity Incorporated... Well, Infinity Incorporated is the weak point of all 3 of these. it falls into a trap that a number of the Baxter format series DC was publishing in the 80s did, which is that because of the restrictions of the comics code weren't really there, the books had room to expand, and there's a lot of filler too. It's just, none of them were wholly successful in the way that I was hoping they would be. One of the more notable things about this part of Infinity Inc., by the way, is that Todd McFarlane does the art. It's not too bad. Damning Todd McFarlane with faint praise, by the way. There's a lot of the flourishes that we eventually came to know him for, but he's a lot more reined in at this point, and the Baxter format serves his art well. And with that, we come upon the very last character to talk about, which is Superman. Now, if I were doing this chronologically, as far as the events within the DC Universe, the All-Star Squadron Infinity Inc. issues would be the last part. There's the better stopping point. That's because the changes from Crisis take hold because Mechanique finally lets everything go. But I have said that Man of Steel number one is the beginning of the true post-Crisis era. So I want to and need to end with whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. Before I get to that, I want to say three things. First, the last issue of DC Comics Presents, which is 97, I think, is a pre-Crisis story that's a sequel to the Phantom Zone miniseries from a few years earlier. Steve Gerber, who wrote that miniseries, writes this issue, and the art is by Rick Veitch, and it's just odd. There's a whole thing about the Phantom Zone being the essence of the cosmic being. During the course of the story, Metropolis is destroyed. There's all sorts of unanswered questions that make you wonder, is this even continuity? I don't even know if I'd recommend it. I mean, it's one of the weirder Superman stories I've ever read. I would recommend, though, the two-part Lois Lane miniseries written by Mindy Newell and drawn by Gray Morrow. It's two double-sized issues. I'm pretty sure this is probably going to be a four-issue mini, but because of the machinations of Crisis, maybe publishing schedules, deadlines, etc., and the Byrne reboot coming along, they made it a two-parter to close out Lois Lane for the pre-Crisis. In this series, Lois is investigating a series of child murders. It's really mature about a very serious issue, and Newell writes it very well. I really like Morrow's art. Lois has always been a great character, but it's cool here to see her do something that doesn't involve Superman. I think this was reprinted in the Greatest Detective Stories ever told trade or something like that from a few years back. It's not too hard to come by in the back issue bins. If you find both issues of it, go ahead and grab them. And now, before I get to the concluding Superman story, I want to point out that John Wilson did an outstanding podcast in the last couple of years, Superman in Crisis. He covers all of Crisis on Infinite Earths, but he also covers every single Superman story that was published during that time, whether or not they intersected with Crisis. And he ends, of course, with Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. Since John has access to all of the books from this era, he does a thorough job. It's wonderful to listen to. I only had a few issues to go by. Now, I covered The Ends of World's Finest a number of years ago, right around the time Batman vs. Superman came out. So go ahead and check that out if you're interested. And aside from a few random comics that I've plucked out of back issue bins, the only stuff I have from this era of Superman, this post-Crisis hangover, is Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. And I didn't even have those issues. I bought it in a slim two-issue prestige format volume that DC published in 1997. Now, nowadays, this is available in various forms, including the DC Infinite app. But the problem with that is that anything prior to that, with the exception, I think, of a few issues that come out around the Crisis, is like really lacking. Like there's all these huge holes in the Superman books, especially Action Comics during the Bronze Age. I hope that they start putting more of them up there because I find them fascinating to read. So if you want to get the whole story of how Superman's time through Crisis and toward the end of Crisis and after Crisis went, check out Superman in Crisis by John Wilson. Definitely worth it. Now, as for this story, if you're unfamiliar with it, it's by Alan Moore. It has pencils by Kurt Swan. Inks on part one are by George Perez. Inks on part two are by Kurt Schaffenberger. The story is, as Moore writes at the beginning, an imaginary story, but aren't they all? And it opens 10 years after anyone has seen Superman. A reporter comes to interview Lois Lane. She goes by Lois Elliott now. And she relates to him the story of Superman's last battle. Basically, a number of Superman's villains get thrown at him in Metropolis, that's Bizarro, the Toyman, the prankster Metallo. And during the course of this, Clark Kent is revealed to the public to be Superman because the prankster and Toyman had tortured it out of the now-dead Pete Ross. Fearing for the safety of his closest friends, Superman takes them all to the Fortress Solitude, where he faces off against the Kryptonite Man, the Phantom Zone villains, the Legion of Superheroes, and the new Luther Brainiac team. It's pretty freaky. Brainiac's, like, robot skull grafts itself onto Luther, making him kind of like this weird zombie type of character. Eventually, the villain behind all of this is revealed to be Mr. Mixies Pitlick. The imp says his motivation is that he has decided to become evil and destructive. Superman kills him using a Phantom Zone projector while he's trying to escape back to the fifth dimension. But then seeing that he's broken his code of not killing, steps into a chamber of gold kryptonite, and he's never seen again. In the future, the reporter concludes Lois's interview just as her husband Jordan comes home. And in the last panels, we see her young son crush coal and turn it into a diamond, and Jordan Elliott winks at us. Now, I left out a lot of details here. I'm going to make a small assumption that a lot of people who are listening to this show have read this story and or are familiar with it. When I first read it in 1997, I remember thinking it was one of the best Superman stories I'd ever read. Granted, at that time, my experience with Superman pre-crisis is limited to like maybe 3 or 4 issues on a miniseries. So, you know, yeah, I mean, my favorite stories, and it's still my favorite stories of Superman, are all the post-crisis era. And that's where I kind of live. But that was 27 years ago. I've reread it a number of times. I've read a lot of other Superman from before the Byrne run. What do I think of it now? Well, I'll say that the art is gorgeous. I was never a huge fan of Kurt Swan when I was younger. There's still some times where I find that his art just doesn't work for a particular story that I'm reading, but he really is the only person I could have thought to draw Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. And I will also say that both Perez and Schaffenberger are outstanding inkers for him. Now, I didn't read the original issues, and I was reading a reprint, and the artwork had been gussied up a little bit, but DC did like a really good job with that. Not muddying up like some modern recolorings tend to do these days. Now, as for the story, I'm still enjoying reading it. But now that I have a little more knowledge of Superman, etc., I get the criticism I've heard. And one of which was that it's more of a send-off to the Silver Age Superman than the Bronze Age Superman. The Bronze Age Superman is a little bit different than what we see in this story. And granted, the months leading up to Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow were full of a lot of one-off stories instead of just building up to a big finale to the character. So I get the impression that DC was just kind of keeping time until the John Byrne reboot launched. And if I'm being honest, I'm curious as to what a Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow written by Elliot S. Magan and or Kerry Bates would have been like. They wrote so much of the Bronze Age Man of Steel that they would have been great choices if Alan Moore hadn't stepped in and taken the story. To be fair, Moore does tell a very good story. It's enjoyable. It does feel like a nice farewell, even if it's pretty brutal throughout. Then again, what Alan Moore story isn't brutal? Anyway, it fits with DC's move toward more sophisticated storytelling in the 1980s. I prefer For the Man Who Is Everything from Superman Annual number 11, but Whatever Happens to the Man of Tomorrow does feel like the event that it needs to be. DC could have very well just quietly ended things and gone right to Byrne, shoving aside the old in favor of the new, but they gave the character a proper send-off, at least in some regard, in my opinion, anyway. What would I have done differently? Well, I mean, I'm no authority on anything, so you could just take what I say with a grain of salt. But I might have brought in a few elements of recent issues, or at least tied it to the then continuity in some way that made the story feel a little more organic and a little less out of place. But I see how this story could have been picked up by a lot more people than a regular set of Superman readers, and you don't want it to bog down in continuity. I don't know. That's a minor quibble with it anyway. The bigger thing is its ending. And I know this is a bone of contention. In the story, Mixie transforms from a fifth dimensional imp to a dark, monstrous being that is bent on destruction. To stop him, Superman winds up having to kill him, and then he just decides to quit being Superman and steps into the gold kryptonite chamber. I feel like Moore writes this scene very well. It has the appropriate tone and mood. And plus, it uses one of the Silver Age tropes that looks silly on its surface. You know, the seemingly dozens of iterations of kryptonite. It uses that pretty effectively. But I don't know if I agree with the idea that Superman would just quit. If I were writing this story, yeah, I know, and my goal was to have Superman lose his powers but end up living, like having a happy ending with Lois where he's living as a regular person, like he can never get his powers back, I would have had him fight Mixie in that giant demon form. But the battle itself would cost him his powers. Like, he uses them all up, or Mixie exposes him to gold kryptonite, but because Superman is still Superman, he fights as best as he can, and he's able to destroy Mixie's Pitlick. I mean, who knows if that's a good idea? I'm just spitballing, but it does kind of bother me that he just quits. But I do like this as the true end to the pre-Crisis era. As much as Crisis number 12 feels like an old school DC Comics story, so does whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. With Man of Steel number 1, there would be a new version of the DC Universe truly in place. And as you go through the latter part of the 1980s, there really is a shift in the tone of everything. And we're nearly 40 years removed from Crisis, so it's a bit disingenuous to evaluate its effects at this point, especially I think since DC's rebooted their continuity about half a dozen times since then. Besides, I started reading DC Comics a good 5 years after Crisis, so I wasn't even there for the ending and new beginning. It's fascinating to have read and watched all of this, because Crisis and the shift to the post-Crisis DCU was such a huge gamble, and whether you like it or not, it did pay off for the company. Some characters obviously suffered. In the Justice Society, other Golden Age characters are among the biggest examples. Green Lantern meandered after the Crisis until Emerald Dawn in the 1990 ongoing series and then the Kyle Rayner era. But a bunch of other characters and concepts got new life. I love the post-Crisis version of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. I love the cohesion of a lot of the post-Crisis DCU. Especially that first, like, decade or so of it. Yes, there's continuity issues, et cetera, et cetera. But it felt more that I was in one place as opposed to kind of like a smattering of different books and things like that were all published at the same time. And I really, really like that about the latter part of the 1980s with DC. Because everything does seem to be firing on all cylinders. And even the things that don't work are still interesting in the very least. The 90s, well, we've had that conversation. Ultimately, this reading project was fun, and that's what I wanted out of it. And if it's an endorsement for anything, like I said, it's an endorsement for the DC Infinite app. I mean, that's where I've read most of these books, unless I had them in trade. Really, though, I'm glad I got to go down this comic book rabbit hole, and I was very happy to have taken you with me. Next episode, I'm falling down another rabbit hole, which is song parts. Confused? Back in about a month. Check it out. Till then, thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panarese. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.